Welcome to Season 3 of the UK Virtual School Podcast with your host, Sid, educational disruptor and founder of the first online school that dares to be different. Our third season marks the end of the third academic year, where we interview parents, students and teachers who are part of the UK Virtual School family. If you are new to our podcast, please do check out the golden gems from seasons 1 and 2. Now, this podcast is for homeschoolers, home educators, world schoolers, and those parents seeking for an alternative that is effective, flexible, and high quality. If this sounds like you, why not join us in disrupting education as we know it and creating a legacy of learning that's full of passion and enthusiasm. Welcome to the UK Virtual School Podcast. Hi guys, welcome back to another podcast with UK Virtual School. And today we're going to be talking about science experiments in the home. And I've got the amazing William with me, and he's going to discuss his kitchen chemistry classes that he does at UK Virtual School. William has been with us for a year and a bit now. We have started our next academic year, 2023 to 2024. And this year, he is also head of secondary as well. But we're going to be looking at his role at UK Virtual School from a science perspective and all the amazing experiments he does. So William always gets a call out from the parents at every parent meeting for the amazing science experiments he does. So hi William, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your background first. Like, what got you into teaching science? Is that something that you went into directly?
Yes, I haven't done a proper job in my life. I've always been a teacher. So I did chemistry at university, studied my master's project was involved in optical tweezing, which is taking laser beams and moving about little microscopic particles with that. And then left university and didn't really know what to do. So thought I'll teach for a few years just to sort myself out. And then about, 14 years later, still teaching away. A lot of teaching experience and a lot of chemistry and biology experience.
So when you studied chemistry at uni, did you know that you wanted to do that for a while beforehand? Or was that like a last minute thing because you enjoyed chemistry at school?
In terms of choosing chemistry, was very much, it was my favourite subject. It's the one I enjoyed the most. So that's, I thought, well, why not just carry on? The end of university, because no one really sits down and tells you, you're going to do that subject every day for 4 years. So you really have to love it. And I like chemistry a lot. And even I was like, by the end of that 4 years, I thought, we might need a small break here. And research science is fascinating, but it doesn't work most of the time. You spend a lot of time just your experiment failing. And it was that sort of prophetic gratitude I had when the experiment worked that made me think perhaps teaching the subject would be more enjoyable than trying and just not getting anywhere.
So did you do a 4 years undergraduate integrated
Yes.
master's thing similar to what I did? Yeah. So you did four, and then you did a research master's after that?
No, it was part of the undergraduate. The last year of my undergraduate degree was doing you're in with a proper research group, doing some research science, which is a fantastic experience, absolutely amazing, but gave you a real taste of what it was like, sort of academic science was like. So yes, I did that for a year and then went into teaching.
So it's a different way that we did it. So I also did a 4-year integrated master's program, but the fourth year we didn't actually do any experiments. It was all theory based and modeling. So we used a lot of modeling software to model what would happen in different situations. And I guess I was doing theoretical physics and applied math, so it wasn't really experimental. But in your case, you were actually doing the experiments and collecting the data and then analyzing that data?
Yes. No. And I can't remember what there's a publication as well. My name is in, I can't remember, something like Optics Express or Optics Journal. It made it sound like an optician's journal. But some data I generated has been published. So it really was a fantastic experience. Absolutely amazing. It's one of those things you look back on and think, gosh, I was incredibly lucky to have done that. Not everyone gets a chance to just muck about doing an experiment for a year and seeing how it goes. And generating results and all that. So I was very lucky.
And it sounds like that was more physics. If you're using lasers and looking at beams and stuff, was that not more physics and chemistry?
It was the physical chemistry department I was working in. I was always a better theoretical chemist than practical chemist. So I went for the labs that were sort of less smelly chemicals and more in the ways of it was more like Meccano mucking about with the laser beams. It was but it was absolutely fascinating, and it would tie in with your sort of theoretical physics. It was very mathematical at that stage in terms of trying to work out and predict what would happen. It was you look back. I found my project. I moved house recently and found my project, which I kept. My good, I tried to read through it. Geez, oh, it's a different language now. I just couldn't do. Maths is extraordinary. You stop doing it and then suddenly it just goes. It's like, I guess, like French or Spanish or whatever. And so, yes, the 21-year-old me was a much better mathematician.
Yeah, we look back on it, the amount of learning, because I remember for one of the exams in my third year, I believe, I had to derive Einstein's E equals MC squared from first principles. And I didn't know how to do it. I just memorized the four pages of how to derive, and I managed to get full marks on that section. But it's like, you look back and you're like, I did that stuff. Like, it's amazing how when you're in that field and that's what you're breathing in every single day for 4 years, it's amazing what you can achieve.
Oh, entirely, entirely. But I suspect students, if they looked back, if they sort of dropped a subject and then went back, it doesn't have to be a university level thing. If you hadn't done art for 4 years at school and then you looked at some of your artwork, you might think, gosh, that was quite impressive that I managed there. It's sort of, so it's a skill that you, once you stop doing something and then look back and see what you were, how accomplished you were at it and what you could do and achieve, always is quite impressive.
Or with art, you might look back and go, oh, I was not good at that, and I thought I was.
Well, I regret bitterly messing about in my art lessons at school, and because it would have been such a nice thing to have a skill at, or even just properly tried. But no, it was Friday afternoons.
You can still learn, right? It's never a skill that you can't learn. I think art is one of those things you can pick up at any point, and I think the older you are when you pick it up, the more impressed you get with your ability, because your hand-eye coordination has developed a lot more by the time you're like a little older than high school.
Well, I guess I need to watch some of Teacher Lucy's videos and just try and do the same as the children. It's one of these skills, isn't it, that you just think, actually, one of these sort of youth is wasted on the young moment. So you've got these opportunities that you don't take, and if you did have your time again, what would you do instead? And not saying I'm regretting my youth at all. I enjoyed it tremendously. But there are some things you think, wow, imagine being able to do that. That would be really fun.
Yeah, I think we don't appreciate it while we're still students. And I think I look back at my university 4 years and I was like, if I actually really were into this physics and learning about Einstein's equation, and I really didn't just learn it off by heart, like, it would have been an amazing experience to actually understand what I was regurgitating in the exams.
And that's what teaching does, isn't it? Is that it makes you understand it much, much better. And because you're thinking about it so much more because you're explaining it to someone else. And so I'm definitely a better chemist than I was at university in some respects, because I've thought about what's been going on a lot more.
It's the one thing I realized, like, when you go into teaching, you realize actually you've never understood any of the concepts that you thought you knew, because you know that the student will ask you why does something happen, so you need to understand why it happens, and you realize you don't. I did not know that you weren't into your practical lab stuff, because I was also the same. I picked theoretical physics because I did not like labs in sixth form. I just did not like it. I would sit at the back and I'd watch everyone else do it. And then as a teacher walked closer to me, I would like just touch the equipment to make it look like I'm actually participating. But I'd rather just be given the data and just be told like what I need to know, because it wasn't my thing. But in that first year at uni, even though we were all doing theoretical physics because we didn't want to do lab work, in order for us to get a physics degree, we had to do 6 weeks of labs. It was the most awful experience. We were just all sat there going, right, you touch that. No, you touch that. You do that. Was there a lot of experimental stuff for you in the first 3 years before your research program?
There was a sort of, you had to tick off certain credits and things. But it was, again, I think it comes down to this understanding, is that when I was doing the labs, I wasn't really thinking about it and what was going on. And therefore, you were doing it just like baking or cooking. It's just following a recipe. And some of the labs are really cool. I mean, we made I remember making a superconductor that you poured liquid nitrogen over it and it got really, really cold and it would levitate a magnet, stuff like that.
This is physics. This is not chemistry.
Well, I can remember the other lab, the organic chemistry labs, they're quite smelly, they're quite long, and you're making a colourless liquid. And you're spending ages making a colourless liquid, which, hours, days sometimes to produce this colourless liquid that you then run your tests on to see what it is. But a friend of mine worked out, we thought, well, hang on, we're spending all this time doing this. Why don't we work out beforehand what it is we need to get, what we're going to produce? So we did. And then you can use techniques like infrared spectroscopy or NMR data to work out what it is, identify what parts of the molecules you can have. And then we would go to the storeroom, collect the chemicals of the right functional groups, run our little data on that, and then proudly present it as our, we've done the lab, here it is. So again, I think that's the theoretician just saying. But this is the thing about the experiments, because looking back at the school ones, having taught experiments now, there's sort of two ways you can view it in the experiments. Is you do an experiment to sort of highlight a point, and that's a bit more in terms of the go through a recipe type thing. But you've got to try and make students think about it. And why are we doing this? What's the point of doing this? Rather than just as the doing it for doing it's sake. And that's what I said in my school lab experience was very much a bit of a prat about. So, you are prat to your desk, you can chat to your mates. And when I try and teach it, you want them to be doing it for to realise the benefit of it and to think about why they're doing certain things and what's the science behind this. And the other bit, which is much harder to do in schools, is the sort of cutting edge side, is where you're doing an experiment and you don't know what the result's going to be, and which is trying to mimic more science at the sort of research end, where what's going to happen here, I don't know, you don't know, let's see what happens, and then can we sort of post-rationalise and work out and provide an explanation for this? And I think that is that's the holy grail for teaching science and doing an experiment, because that generates the excitement, that generates the interest of, I don't know what's going on here, and something weird might be happening, let's try and work out why our results are as they are.
Isn't there a danger of creating something that's dangerous then? Like you said that the labs were smelly at university. Like, how did you know that you weren't creating something that was going to have an impact on the people in the room, right? Like, how do you know they're not going to all pass out once this liquid gets formed?
Well, again, the down the sink policy of everything. Any waste product down the sink one time backfired, where there was a loud gurgling and a nasty smell definitely came up. But apart from that, there were pretty benign chemicals that we were using. In my youth, I probably probably accepted the university risk assessment policies for the chemicals. I'm sure they wouldn't have given us anything particularly nasty. In terms of this sort of the cutting edge stuff, I guess you have to try and work out what it is you're producing. I mean, you've got a vague idea of what should be happening, so you're trying to minimise the risk for that. But then again, some things, the unexpected, you can't. And so you try and every time you do a practical, it's all about minimising risk. You can never eliminate it entirely.
Yeah. And I think that's where the danger is, where schools have got so much of a prescribed list of experiments because they want to minimise that risk as much as they can. But then the danger is that you're not having that fun element attached to it where the kids are really learning. It just makes me think of, I don't know what you did for A-levels, but we did advancing physics. And I don't know what exam board that was, I've forgotten now. But advancing physics gave you the choice of being able to pick what you wanted to do for your experiment to showcase a particular topic. So for example, I remember I love textiles. I was a very artistic student. I did art and I did textiles and I did physics and maths. And for my advancing physics experiment, we had to do something around Young's modulus. So which is like stress over strain. And I decided to do something textiles based because that was what I was interested in. So I was like experimenting denim and cotton and all the fabrics that I would use in my textile to see which materials had a higher Young's modulus. So do you think that experiments, like I really enjoyed that because it combined my textiles and my physics knowledge together. Did you have a similar experience for chemistry at A-level, or was yours a lot like how it is with GCSE?
I did the Salters A-level course, which is very experimental heavy, and you have a project to do. So I was mucking about with natural indicators and generating profiles to see which indicators could be used for certain titrations. So cabbage juice, blueberries, things like that. And having taught the IB, it's International Baccalaureate Chemistry, they have projects as part of that. And again, what they're looking for is that sort of linking chemistry to a real world context, like your fabrics. So you find having an idea, looking at something in your life, and then extrapolating a science experiment from that, which when it works is utterly brilliant. So there was a girl, there was one project on Japanese bubble tea, and we went into, and it's made using, I think it's calcium chloride solution. And we tested different group two metal ions to see which would provide the best, sort of the most rigid bubble for the bubble tea. And then tested the force of them by squishing them and how much force was taken to burst them. And it was utterly brilliant. It was really interesting. It was one of those, again, that moment of, I've no idea what's going on here in terms of what results we're going to get. I can't predict this one. And then when we got our results, we managed to then work out, sort of finding something analogous in chemistry that happens called Crown ethers. And we sort of applied that logic to it. And it's that wonderful, it was that brilliant moment of, we've got something that we've taken a real world example, we've turned it into an experiment in a lab, we've applied our knowledge and taken knowledge from other science that makes sense. And it's come up with a good answer that matches our results. And that was that sort of perfect science moment of, yeah, this is what experimentation should be about. And you could see the interest it generates. And where those type of projects fail is where someone just kind of wants to do it for doing its sake. And they could already work out the answer in their head if they put a bit of thought or look up on Google. And so it's that idea of trying to generate. And this is what we try and do with the year sevens, where we run projects at the end. We looked at the Mentos and Coke experiment, which is the sort of popular experiment, but we tried it at different temperatures to see which would produce the biggest sort of eruption. I won't reveal the results because it will be there. But I was surprised when we did the experiment. I was surprised how it panned out. Next week, we did a little research to try and work out whether we could see what explain the results, and we did.
My understanding of chemistry was very limited, right? Because I didn't do it at A-level. Actually, I was going to do A-level chemistry, and then the A-level chemistry teacher told me that, like, we were just going to spend most of the year looking at tritation and just having, like measuring droplets of a liquid. I was like, I don't fancy doing that. She put me off chemistry. And so when you mentioned tritation, I was like, yeah, I remember that. But my understanding, I don't know whether this is going to be right, and I'm sure you're not going to tell me because you don't want to mess it up for the listeners. But I would say that the rate of experiment, like the rate of reaction increases with temperature, but I assume there's a limit at which the chemicals won't work the same way. I'm sure it goes up and then it kind of just stops working. I don't know, maybe.
You have to do the experiment to find out. This is it.
So what was the highest temperature you went to? Was it just using boiling water?
So we did, it was about, what was it in the end? 50 degrees in the end, I think. It was the highest temperature we did. One at room temperature was about 20 on that day. One at 50, and I had one bottle that was kept in the fridge. So that was about four. So we did three just to see what the different effect.
Are you not changing the chemical makeup of the Coke, though, by warming it up that much?
I didn't think so. I don't think Coke decomposes on heating.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a chemist. I don't know.
No, it wasn't. I wouldn't have thought so. But the questions it generated then from the students was fantastic, because they were then saying, well, what about, because I did fruit Mentos when I was doing it. And one of them said, what about the mint Mentos? Would that be different? And I'm like, do an experiment to find out. Or what about other sweets? And different types of cake.
Oh, yeah. There's so many variables.
Exactly. And this was generated. So, and they were firing these questions. Gang, I don't know. I haven't researched this that much. If you want to do it and have a look. Do your own little experiments and see. That was definitely, that was an exciting end to the year for year seven.
That sounds really good. It sounds brilliant. So we want to talk about, we've already started, but science experiments in the home. Like, I think there's a misconception that when you start home educating, like all experiments will just be video recordings online. And I think you've brought a lot of science experimentation into the lessons. You teach primary science as well. And then you go all the way up to GCSE. So share with us some of your, so you've got the Mento and Coke one. What other amazing kitchen chemistry stuff does William get up to?
Well, there's plenty you can do. And there's plenty of demonstrations as well for those things that are slightly more dangerous that you don't sort of want a child doing at home. So in terms of the interesting experiments that you can do at home, there's lots of things you can do with indicators, because you can get all the chemicals you need quite cheerfully. Lots of stuff from just regular grocery shops. So vinegar, baking soda, Epsom salts. You can get a few cleaning products. Might contain things like ammonia and stuff like that, which is always handy. So you, in terms of sourcing this stuff, is generally fairly straightforward. In terms of the experiments we can do, well, there's one of this is a, sort of the major challenge of an online science teacher is looking at the normal experiments you do in class and then thinking, can we now adapt this to home? And what other chemicals is, and it's sourcing the chemicals is the sort of thing you have to research and look into. But I think this year, just doing a quick off the head calculation, we looked at, in terms of separation techniques, so we looked at things like filtration, we looked at chromatography, we set up a, evaporation crystallization. We've done some cooling curve experiments, calorimetry experiments.
What is that?
Calorimetry, just heating up water to measure the temperature rise.
Makes it sound so complicated, like just say water heating, like come on.
This is a teacher's job, is to make sound important. we've done demonstrations burning magnesium and looking at combustion in that way. It was the most nervous I've been filming something. It was all in a live lesson. I pre-filmed this one. I didn't want to drop burning magnesium myself mid-lesson.
But let me share something about magnesium, because I've done that experiment in our science workshops, and if you're not meant to directly look at it, and I hope you didn't because it can blind you, right? And they used to use magnesium to give the flash in cameras once upon a time. You know, the earlier cameras where you had the bright flash? And so momentarily people used to go blind because they used to be looking at the flash and it would just flash in their faces and make them blind. But yeah, there were some really weird uses of some of the chemicals that are quite dangerous. You're not meant to be looking at a magnesium burning. We're so used to the science around us that sometimes we don't pause and think about how things work. Like, we're just so used to things working. And it's really fascinating when there was a kid recently, we're doing an experiment on electricity in some of the workshops that I do locally. They were learning about electricity and whether certain objects use batteries or certain objects use sockets, as in power sources to power them. And they couldn't figure out what a refrigerator does because they haven't seen the back of the refrigerator. So they didn't know it had a plug attaching it to the wall. And so sometimes like you're using stuff every day, but you don't stop to think about like, how does this actually function? And so younger kids have this innate curiosity where they will ask why, like, why is this working? Why is it this way? Why is it that way? And I think it's so fascinating because it makes you stop and pause and think like, I don't know how that actually works.
Exactly. And this is the thing with, because science has this slight reputation of being sort of the panacea that it can explain everything. And it's nice when you can bring in examples where it can't. So there's the Mpemba effect, which was this Kenyan schoolboy. They were making ice cream. He was behind his classmates. So they all mixed together all their stuff and had to heat it whilst they mixed it, cooled it down, and then they popped it in the freezer. And he was slightly behind the others, so he didn't bother cooling it down once he mixed everything together and put his mixture in the freezer hot. And his ice cream formed quicker than the other people's. And so which suggests that, the hot mixture cooled much quicker rates than the cold mixtures. Which is weird because there must have been one moment in time when they're the same temperature and yet their particles were behaving differently. And the RSC ran this big competition, I think, to try and, because no one can really explain it. And they've got a vague explanation, but it's not something that people go, yep, that is the definite reason for this happening. And it's things like that that are just absolutely incredible. These things are absolutely incredible.
Isn't that the same reason why, like, we used to do this experiment in school when I used to teach in a physical school environment. With the year sevens, we did this, where the scenario was you're making tea and the phone rings. Should you pour in the milk before you take the phone call or after you take the phone call? Like, what's going to keep your tea the warmest, right? And isn't that the same sort of experiment though with the fridge, with the freezer? Because it's just in the other direction.
And so, well, it was more a case of why did his ice cream form first though? Because his one's got a bigger Because his ice cream was formed before the other, his ice cream froze before the other people's.
But isn't that for the same reason of, like, if you've got two different cups of coffee, tea, and you're pouring milk in one first, you would think the one that you're cooling down first by pouring in the milk will be cooler than the one after. But I think it's the other way around. I can't remember what the actual answer is now. I need to kind of do the experiment.
What's the explanation, though?
There was an explanation for that, because I remember teaching it and going, this is why it works. But I'm going to have to think about it again, because I've completely forgotten, because it's been so long. Yeah, it's really weird, though, how some things you can't explain, simple things.
Exactly. And this is where, again, you try and sort of, when you teach, you try and expose people to these ideas. And I always like to at some point mention Richard Feynman in my classes, and just show them where to find YouTube footage usually of him giving his lectures or talking. He did a brilliant BBC program in the 80s that you can find online. And he is the ultimate in terms of scientific teaching. He can get a really complicated idea and just put it in so lucidly, so clearly.
You're a hidden physicist, William. Feynman is a physicist.
My maths isn't good enough. Okay, I mentioned Sir Harry Crotty. He's a great speaker too. My maths isn't good enough for physics. It was never that level. There's always a plodder, which where chemistry suited slightly better.
But Feynman is like one of the most well-known physicists there is, right?
But his level of communication is stunning. That's the most impressive thing. Is how he can convey these ideas that are really complicated. And one of the favourite clips I've seen is sort of, because I used to teach this course called Theory of Knowledge for the International Baccalaureate, of explaining how people think. And I had to teach to sort of explain how scientists think, which at 18 I would have hated. It would have been just, tell me what I need to know. Don't tell me, analyse how I think. As a man in my 30s, I found it absolutely fascinating seeing and comparing how would a historian think compared to how would a scientist think compared to how lawyers think. You know, it's fascinating how a lawyer thinks. Geez, they have a different mindset entirely. Breaking down and trying to analyse how you establish something. And this is what students always bring up, is what you're teaching us is a theory, it's a science, what happens if it changes? Think, well, it might do. It might. This is called the paradigm shift. You know, we might be teaching you the wrong stuff and we find something that changes our theory entirely, and then we have to go in a different direction. And so, again, it's that slight, not only to undermine the subjects, but getting across the idea that science doesn't quite have all the answers, and it is very much, it is built upon theories that are established or accepted truths and accepted facts. And that's something, again, that you can do with experimentation. And you can see, well, this is our theory. Let's do an experiment. If our experiment doesn't match the theory, our theory is wrong. Our guess is wrong. We need to go back to the drawing board. And trying to sort of establish that through experimentation is brilliant.
We've created separate subjects. The education system has separated the subjects. Essentially, that's what they're trying to get you to do. Like when you're in a science lesson, you're doing science. You're thinking like a scientist, right? Even though it's not explicitly said, like, you need to think like a scientist, the implication is there. But then there's also an argument for interdisciplinary cross-curricular learning, where then you are merging your thinking, but it's still like very powerful though, right? So there's an argument on both ways, and yeah, it's a strange one.
Well, I guess you're right, because I guess I didn't really think, I said, no, I just bumbled through school. I didn't really know what I thought.
As a kid, you just have too much of a good thing and you don't really appreciate it, right? When you've got school every single day for like 10 years on end, you're not going to appreciate it. And it's only as an adult where now you have to pay to go to university or pay to do a course, where you're like, oh, if I save up and I do this, I'm going to put my all into it and I'm going to make sure I understand it. So I think too much of something stops us from appreciating the beauty of it as well. Like, it's like when you live in a local vicinity and you've got amazing architecture around you, you don't appreciate it as much as a tourist coming in and seeing it for the first time. You might not have even gone and seen your local tourist sites because it's just normal for you, right? So I guess it's the same way in the schooling system for a lot of kids. It's a norm for them.
Yeah, I guess so. And then, I mean, growing up's hard enough as it is, right? Having to analyse how you think all the time. I should be thinking like a scientist. You're busy trying to make friends instead and just be...
And you're still trying to figure out how, like, who you are as a person, knowing how, like, you think yourself before you start thinking like someone else.
Now I'm telling them they must be like Einstein.
Going back to your kitchen chemistry stuff, because I know you do some garden chemistry as well, and I'm assuming you reserve that for all your messy stuff for the garden. Do you get the kids also doing the experiments at the same time?
If it's practical, if it's the sort of the chemicals or the requisition stuff is easy to get, then yes. And also there's the safety aspect as well, because we don't want to be anyone causing any damage to themselves or their property. So in terms of I do the risk assessment of, is this something that you could do at home, and then send an email home with the chemicals required, tell the parents what's going on so they can decide whether they want to supervise or not. If it's not, I think it's going to be too difficult depending on the year group and the sort of age range of the pupils, then I'll try and demo it instead. And this could be me demoing it during the live during the lesson, or for some of them you pre-record because you don't want to be fooling about with your sort of teaching lesson whilst doing an experiment, just in case something were to go wrong.
But that's the beauty of an experiment. Like, you have to have things going wrong to show that things do go wrong, right?
There's going wrong and there's going wrong. So in my second week of teaching, I think the head of department told me, white phosphorus, this will get your standing up with the pupils. Get some white phosphorus and let it spontaneously combust. And white phosphorus is really nasty stuff. I think it was a hangover from, I think it has been in the lab stocks for years. It was used in smoke grenades. It used to be used in bullets, but it got banned because it sticks to your skin and then it burns with a very hot flame and lets out this very white acrid smoke. But it can be stored safely underwater. So it's left underwater, it's fine, nothing happens. So I took out the chunk of white phosphorus and cut a little bit off. I was getting the stick back with the tweezers, about to pop it back underwater. And then I saw the big stick just go up and dropped it on the front bench, and it sort of melted the front of the bench. The lab filled with this acrid smoke. And so when it goes wrong, it can really... evacuated the lab, got them all out. Gosh, and that was sort of week two of teaching. And this is half the fun, and you try and... So you try and recreate and see, how could I do this in the lab? Because you want to see people to see these things. So I spent a long time with sieves and flour out of my garden and a candle trying to get that to set fire to flour. And that hasn't quite worked for me yet. So I need to work on a better system for that.
Your neighbours are going to be thinking, what on earth are you doing?
Exactly. Well, that's very true. But I'll pre.
Is that why you had to move houses, William? Because you've recently moved. Like, did they get suspicious?
I was bringing down the house prices and all the glare. yes. So there are more experiments I want to do, but I think it will need a bit of thought on how I can conduct them safely and work out that. Yes. So, and that's the joy of it. So each year going through, want to try and see what can I get, where can I improve on the experimental side? Because that's the big bit. That's the sort of toughest bit in terms of what can I get in here and what can we do? And so we're constantly reviewing and constantly looking up for new ideas or of how things can be done.
And we're hoping to do a 1 week residential lab week for the kids as well at some point. We keep talking about it has to be done at some point, where we take the kids away for a week somewhere in the UK and we just do all the experiments we can't actually do at home and get them to trial them out, because they'll remember it more if they've done it themselves as well.
And that would be good for the especially for the more quantitative stuff that you, where you generate results as well, that you can't do in a kitchen because no one owns a burette and no one owns a pipette and volumetric flask and things like that. And so for that level of things, yes, because you can't, unless you're willing to spend hundreds of pounds on lab equipment that you use a few times, it's not really feasible.
Yeah, so thank you so much. I've really enjoyed having that conversation today about all things experimental. Who would have known two theoretical physics chemists are talking about just experiments, right? We're going to put together some of William's kitchen chemistry videos together so that you can have a go at doing some experiments at home. So if you want to experience William's sessions, join UK Virtual School, because he teaches from year 3 all the way up to year 11. So you can enjoy some of his kitchen chemistry. Is there anything else that you want to add, William, before we go?
Just remember to think like a scientist, I think. Just make sure you have that mindset. Test and investigate. If you're not sure why something's happening, set up your own little experiment and see whether you can work out why.
Thank you so much for tuning into the UK Virtual School podcast with your host, Sid. I look forward to having you join me again soon. In the meantime, if you're considering online schooling to take away the stress of having to plan and structure everything yourself, why not head over to our website, www.ukvirtualschool.com. You can join in our next online open day or book in a Zoom meeting with me to discuss options. I look forward to seeing you soon. Bye.